People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. The Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness is pitching a redesigned Canada housing benefit to try and reduce the number of people becoming homeless. Canada's national housing strategy is almost 10 years old. As the federal government ponders the future of housing policy and homelessness response, the Alliance is calling on them to consider working with a metric born at the University of Calgary, the Homelessness Income Cutoff, or HICO. It's defined as the lowest income an individual or family must have to minimize their risk of homelessness. According to a report from the measure's creators, it's an amount well below Canada's official poverty line. It also assumes people are going to be getting help from charities. The number changes based on where you are and who's in your household. In Nanaimo, the baseline HICO for a single person in 2023 was around $16,000. Part of the idea is that if policies leave individuals and families with incomes below the HICO, they cannot claim to be effective responses to the homelessness crisis. I spoke with the founder of the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness about calls for a better housing benefit.
My name is Tim Richter. I lead the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness, and I'm based just east of you in outside Calgary.
And you have set out to answer the question, can housing benefits be designed more effectively to prevent homelessness? Before we get to that, maybe could you walk me through how are housing benefits set up right now?
Well, maybe we'll take even one step back from that and talk about homelessness and housing in Canada. And, from between about 2018 and today, homelessness in Canada has nearly doubled. Unsheltered homelessness, people that are living outside, that has gone up by about 300%. Your listeners will have seen that and experienced it up and down Vancouver Island and in the lower mainland of BC for sure. And a lot of that is down to the cost of living and the cost of rent. And so one of the things we know to be true is that homelessness is a housing problem. It is not caused by mental illness or addiction. It is really driven by increasing rent and decreasing availability, especially in lower income, lower cost units in the rental housing world. And so the explosion of homelessness we've seen in Canada over the last number of years has really been driven by the fact that rent has gone up significantly, right? And your listeners in Nanaimo, Victoria, and the Lower Mainland are going to feel that rent pressure. But so too has the cost of things like food and energy. And if you are a low-income household, you are normally about 85% of your budget is going to be consumed by either your rent or food, right? Or energy or transportation, some of those essentials. And so that's really been driving, the surge in homelessness in the last, the last 8 to 10 years that we've been experiencing. So we started from asking the question, well, how do we stop that? How do we slow that down? And the first is understanding that, that homelessness is a housing problem and is driven by unaffordability. The answer is obviously more deeply affordable housing, more supportive housing. However, that takes a lot of time. So what can you do in the interim? And in the interim, you can use housing benefits. Like, if people are at risk of homelessness or they are in core housing need, they are living in housing, they just can't afford it. So if we can support their income in the short term, we can keep them from being pushed out the bottom of the housing market into homelessness. In the same period that we're talking about, Canada had a Canada housing benefit, but that benefit unfortunately wasn't big enough in terms of the amount of money that it could offer around the country. The budget was $2 billion over 10 years. That is coming up for renewal this in 27-28. The benefit also didn't provide quite enough money. Obviously, the households get dealing with the price of rent wasn't targeted to those in greatest need. And its approach wasn't quite as effective as it could be in terms of supporting people's needs. And so that's how we ended up, sorry to make a short question, a long answer, but that's kind of how we ended up putting together this proposal.
You talk about there the idea of homelessness as a housing problem, and you suggested that it's exploded since 2018 in Canada. Could you tell me about what we know specifically about the pathways that people take into homelessness?
Good question. It varies. It can vary, but more often than not, and the vast majority of people who experience homelessness are in and out very quickly. They experience it very briefly, and it's down to an interruption in income or not, eviction from their housing. But it is largely driven by that unaffordability. So as the end of the month looms large, people will, and they struggle to pay their rent. They'll start by, they'll start restricting their spending on other things. So they'll go to a food bank as opposed to going to buy food, right? Or they will borrow money from friends and family, or they will, get rid of whatever assets they have to keep the lights on, keep their housing. Then, sometimes they'll end up doubling up, like, bringing in other people to live with them, to share the cost of the rent, or they'll go live with friends and family, and they'll do lots of different things to try and avoid that loss of housing. I really feel for these, families that are and individuals that are in this situation, because I can't imagine just how Well, I can't imagine just how stressful and awful it is with the end of the month looming. We're speaking now on the 29th of July, with the end of the month looming large. I guarantee you there are families all over BC, individuals all over BC that just don't know how they're going to pay rent or realize now that they're not going to be able to.
So could you walk me through what kind of housing benefits people have right now, how exactly they work, and what is the ideology or the thinking behind them?
Well, housing benefits, there's all kinds of different forms and types of housing benefits. I'm not totally familiar with all the different benefits you have in BC. There's things like rent banks, there's rent supplements that come through different programs. There's the Canada Housing Benefit that can be delivered in different ways through the province of BC. But typically what happens is it's called a shelter to income ratio type benefit. And typically, and this Canada Housing Benefit is similar in this way, that typically what you're trying to do is bridge the difference between your income and how much your rent is, just to bridge a bit of that gap. But one of the things and one of the reasons we've shifted to this HICO model, homelessness income cutoff, is a realization that you can cover a person's rent, but they still don't have any money to live on. So they could use 100% of their income still, or the majority of the income, and be forced into homelessness because they can't afford some of the essentials. And so we there's this model called the homelessness income cutoff that was developed at the University of Calgary by Ron Nebone and Marguerite Wilkins, who looked at homelessness data and said, well, how is it that what would people need? What would be the minimum people would need in order to prevent their homelessness? And based on their research and understanding the patterns and movement of people into homelessness, they came up with this homelessness income cutoff. And basically what they're saying is, if families are at about 70, are living at about 75% of market basket measure level of poverty in their community, they are at significant risk of homelessness, which means there's about 770,000 households in Canada that we would term in imminent risk of homelessness. Does that mean that people outside that aren't at risk or won't experience it? No, but it does mean that this group is at kind of at imminent risk. And so what they postulated was basically a minimum income level needed to sustain housing and pay for the essentials. in order to prevent a person's homelessness.
So basically, if I've got it right now there are some benefits set up where the whole idea is we're going to make sure you're maybe spending only 30% of your income on housing. And then what you're suggesting is instead we have a measure that says, well, how much money do you need to pay for everything that you need to live? And let's make sure you have that.
Yeah, it's called a residual income approach. And so basically it means that, making sure that you have enough income to pay your rent and some of those essentials after you've done it, like after you've expended all of your effort trying to keep your housing, and you'll still now, this isn't basic income. It's a little bit different than it's not as certainly not as I'll say generous. Now, generous is not the right word, but it is kind of a step in that direction.
In a report from your organization, you suggested that a person being homeless for a year costs the Canadian government around $90,000. Could you explain to me maybe where that figure comes from or what the costs are to society of someone being homeless?
Yeah, there's a lot of different estimates of the cost of homelessness. In one report we were involved in 2016, it estimated that homelessness at that time was costing the Canadian economy about $7.5 billion a year. The costs are really generated by, the cost of everything from, shelters and policing and hospitals and healthcare and all of the related costs that come with people being forced out of their homes and bouncing aimlessly around very expensive public systems, right? And, as you're experiencing homelessness, your health deteriorates, the costs go up because you're going to emergency rooms, you're accessing healthcare more, there's interactions with police, there's using shelters, all of those things have a cost. And it's one of the, one of the big or relatively new understandings of homelessness is just it is far more expensive to fix than it is to ignore, right? And it's far cheaper to prevent it than it is to try and fix it after it happens. And so if we can make an investment in the front end and keep people in their homes, we will save governments, donors, taxpayers tons of money over the longer term by keeping just keeping these people home and safe.
Well, could you talk to me about the ways to do that? Obviously, one of them that you're calling for is this change, this benefit to help people not lose their housing. Is that all there is to it, or what else do people need to know about prevention?
Oh no, I think there is a lot more. There's a lot more to it. When we modeled the impact of the benefit that we're proposing, we saw that we could probably achieve around a 60% reduction in homelessness when we modeled it on homelessness rates in St. John's, Toronto, and Edmonton, where we have really good homelessness data. And that is, I think that's, that is pretty remarkable. But when you think about homelessness, it's kind of a dynamic of movement of people into and out of the system. And, when we, if we wanted to end homelessness, there's a bunch of things we need to do. First, you need to ensure that there's an adequate housing supply. That's the key to prevention, housing and income support. But there's still going to be people that run into certain challenges, addiction, mental illness, brain injury, job loss, all of these things that can be the triggering event. In prevention, it's really important that we are able to, understand the risk, see that it's happening, and intervene in a timely way. And if we can't, you want to create a local system where you can see homelessness happening. You can intervene quickly. You have the data to see a person becoming homeless. You have a coordinated system that responds to them and can move them back into housing so that their experience is rare if it happens, brief when it does, and doesn't happen again. And this is really, really similar to what we do in cases of disaster, right? So, you're seeing these really dreadful fires all over British Columbia right now. Kimberley, other communities are looking at evacuating. Well, when that happens, there is a disaster management system in place where local governments lead, You help people, keep people safe from the emergency, and then you're quickly looking at moving them back into their homes, helping rebuild. We see this happening right now in Jasper, Alberta, after a wildfire a couple of years ago, and we look to see how we can prevent the impact of these things happening again. And that's really, in a nutshell, the system for ending homelessness.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Tim Richter. He's president and CEO of the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness. The organization is calling for a redesigned Canada housing benefit. That's the subject of our conversation today.
It would be more expensive, for sure. We're talking, at its full, at its at it at it. At, You know, our recommended spend would be, at the top end to get all 769,000 households, would be about $7 billion a year, potentially, between the federal government and the provinces for all of Canada. With the old housing benefit, the old Canada housing benefit was about $2 billion over 10 years. So it is expensive, and there's no two ways about that, but it is far cheaper than allowing this to continue. And what cost, what price tag are you going to put on a person's health and well-being? A person experience, a man that experiences chronic homelessness in Canada has a life expectancy of 50 years. A woman who experiences chronic homelessness in Canada has a life expectancy of 35 years, right? And what is that worth? To me, I think this is a worthwhile investment.
For someone who's outside of the policy field, what do you think is most important for them to get out of a conversation like this one?
Couple of things. One, homelessness is a housing problem, right? It's caused by the lack, unaffordable housing. And the key to that is solving the housing problem. In the short term, we can help people stay in their homes by helping them afford the housing they're in. Second thing is, what we've seen in Canada is our communities are actually pretty good at moving people out of homelessness, but the number of people being pushed into homelessness by unaffordable housing and the cost of living is surging. And that's what's causing this. This isn't what you're seeing playing out in BC is not a product of a sudden mental health crisis or a sudden, province-wide addiction crisis or a province-wide mental health crisis. Those things are there. They've always been there. They're getting worse. Like, we're dealing with multiple compounding crises at the moment, like, for example, the toxic drug supply, making things worse. But the underlying cause is housing unaffordability.
Could you tell me more about what you feel or what the evidence shows is driving that housing unaffordability?
Well, it does come down to the cost of housing. So if you go back to the mid-1980s and 1990s, Canada stopped building social housing. We used to build 25,000 units of social housing a year in 1983, 84, right? We stopped that dead in its tracks in 1995. Most of Canada's market rental housing was built before 1980, right? Because in 1980, the government of Canada stopped subsidizing or incentivizing the construction of new rental housing. In that time, population grew, of course, things changed. All the rent and all, the cost of rent over this time has increased exponentially because of that supply. The kind of things you're referring to also make it very difficult. Some things also make it quite difficult to build new housing, right? Municipal zoning rules, permitting delays, taxes, fees. I have a colleague that once said, if you tax housing like you tax cigarettes, you're going to get the same result, right? It's because it's become exponentially harder to build more housing and it's become more expensive. And so the rent goes up. And so, so if you're a low-income household in Canada, since the 90s, your income really hasn't increased in any measurable way, or certainly not increased at the same rate as the cost of that housing. And so, if you look between, 2018 or 2019 and today, the average cost of rent in Canada has gone up 20-30%. The cost of food has gone up 20-30% or more. And so if you're a low-income household, your income has stayed the same, but your groceries cost 30-40% more. your rent's costing 20, 30% more. You don't, there's no way for you to make up that difference, to make up that change. And so you're doing everything you can, working extra jobs, doubling up, doing everything you can to keep your rent and finding the cheapest rent you can in your community. But because there's inadequate supply and it's too expensive, it's very difficult for you to find a place to live.
A number of conversations I have on the program seem to all come back to in the mid-90s, Canada got completely out of the social housing game, and now we're sort of reaping the consequences of that. You also mentioned that homelessness has been exploding since 2018. Is there anything specific about that period that changed or that has changed since then?
Cost of living. That's the biggest thing. You know, I think there was some issues. You know, there were some population growth. There was some cost of living changes. But the fact that we haven't been building housing, haven't been building social housing at scale, the social housing or the affordable housing we have been building isn't really affordable to the people who need it the most. You know, and our, you know, the national housing strategy over the last decade, you know, didn't create enough of the deeply affordable housing that we need in order to prevent this. So that it's really, you know, homelessness is a product of policy, right? They, you know, you often hear say people say, well, you know, homelessness is a choice. It's not an individual choice. It's a policy choice. It's a choice that governments have made to not invest in social housing, not invest in deeply affordable housing or supportive housing in a meaningful way. Or the housing that they have developed has been too expensive. So that's why low-income households are really struggling.
Tim Richter is president and CEO of the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
Every year, more than 1% of kids in Canada have an incarcerated parent, according to a study published this year. It's reportedly the first study to put a credible estimate on the figure, finding that around 170,000 kids had a parent incarcerated across one of five provinces in the study period. Published in PLOS-1, which stands for Public Library of Science, the study was led by researchers at McMaster University who were working with collaborators at universities across the country. Martha Painter was one of the authors on the study. I reached her on the East Coast to learn more.
My name is Martha Painter. I'm an associate professor at the University of New Brunswick Faculty of Nursing and Health Sciences. And I'm also a member, founding member of the Canadian Coalition for Children of Incarcerated Parents. And I've worked in this area for at least 15 years.
And you were part of the team working on a study that found around 170,000 children in Canada had incarcerated parents. Can you put that number in context for me?
So that's about 1% of kids at a given time. And there are limitations to the way we were able to conduct this study, which fortunately we had the partnership of Statistics Canada. So the analysis is very rigorous. But basically that means 1 in 100 kids at least. And that's probably a very serious undercounting, but at least is experiencing parental incarceration at any given moment. And that has implications for how these children experience education, how they experience health systems, their own health outcomes, as well as all kinds of social, environmental, contextual factors.
How easy was it to gather the data to arrive at these numbers?
This was very challenging. And what we did, we had to link several databases in a data linkage environment supported by Statistics Canada. So you have to physically go to Statistics Canada to do this work. And the databases we linked, so there's a relatively new correctional services survey. that StatsCan maintains. And this had data from five provinces about people who had been incarcerated in provincial jails in those five provinces. It's only five, but those are big provinces for the most part, and they constitute over the majority of the population of Canada. So those people in that data set, we then match them with vital statistics data, so records of birth. So if you were listed on a birth certificate as somebody's mother, that is one way we could identify you, matching you from correctional database to vital statistics. We could also match a birth record from the discharge abstracts database, which is basically all the hospital data we have in Canada. So there would be a record of every single discharge for someone who gave birth. So that's another way we could do it. And then the third way we did it was with tax data, because people who are custodial parents receive the Canadian child tax benefit. So it's a mix of biological parent and potentially that social parent getting the tax benefit. And of course, could miss people for all kinds of reasons. So this is a bare minimum. This is the bare minimum of what we were able to connect. So that data matching is quite complicated. Fortunately, like I said, we had the support from Statistics Canada to do that. And the study was funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, because you need funding to access this data.
Well, the press release for this study described those impacted as statistically invisible. Can you tell me more about that idea?
Well, this is the first time we've ever counted these children. So this has been an entirely invisible population up till now. We've had back of the envelope, really vague calculations. We've had very small studies. I recently conducted a survey about sexual and reproductive health in five provincial jails, different from the five provinces we're used in our study of children of incarcerated parents. Anyway, among those in this survey, 91% of people in prisons in the Atlantic Canadian region had children, whereas only 66% in British Columbia jails did. So, you know, we would use numbers like that to try to extrapolate. And we had never had anything as robust as what we were able to publish this past April.
Well, having that information, what does that change? What does that allow you to do?
Without this information, it really leaves this population invisible and theoretical. When you have these numbers, you know these are real children and they have real implications. So studies elsewhere, not in Canada, have shown that children of incarcerated parents, family members of incarcerated people, experience excess morbidity and mortality. There's a very famous study out of the US called the ACEs study, the Adverse Child Event Study from the 90s, that showed that parental incarceration is one of these key, one of a dozen really critical things that can happen to you, events that can happen to you in your childhood that will cause you to be at increased risk of chronic illness and early death. So we know these children are clinically vulnerable. There has never been dedicated work in Canada, for example, from a pediatrics lens to pay attention to these children's needs, to find out what they need in terms of healthcare or social services or educational services. So this is a starting point to be able to say, this is not a small population. This is not some niche, strange experience. It's very common. 1% is very common. We do all kinds of research and all kinds of activities. Public policy is aimed at far fewer people than 1% of our population. So this is an important group that deserve notice and deserve attention and deserve services and program response.
Also, putting that number in context, your study suggested that the rates were a bit higher than in Europe. And for 1 year, 2016, basically half of what they were in the United States as far as the number of children who have incarcerated parents in a year.
Yes. So, but we know this, right? We know that we have far fewer incarcerated people than in the US. But we often give ourselves a pat on the back because we're not the US. But the US incarcerates a third of all prisoners in the world. The US is a mass incarcerator. Comparing ourselves to the US is a fool's errand. However, it is important that we recognize that we do not rank very well in terms of incarceration rates in the Western world. Our rate of incarceration is far higher than many European and Western countries. And that's inexcusable. We do not have excessive crime to justify these high and increasing numbers of incarcerated people. So when we think about our children's well-being, noticing that a disproportionate number of children in Canada are experiencing what is a known adverse child event should bring us pause. We have to reconcile the fact that what we do to an adult, when we incarcerate, when we sentence an adult, there are consequences for their children. And this makes that very blatant, that this makes this real in a way that's only ever been theoretical.
Is there any important context about maybe the current atmosphere or dialogue around the criminal justice system? I'm thinking of points like bail reform. I'm thinking of points like hearing that in Ontario and likely in BC as well, around 80% of people in provincial jails are there on remand, awaiting trial. What do you think people need to know about maybe the current context of the prison system to help wrap their head around this issue we're talking about today of the incarceration of parents?
I think there's two immediate issues here. One is, what is the point? So what are we aiming to achieve through rapidly increasing incarceration? Because it doesn't rehabilitate. It doesn't reduce the rate of crime. So what is the intention? It is extremely expensive and it's fully taxpayer funded in Canada. So we are throwing a lot of taxpayer money at this, at something that doesn't make people well. It doesn't reduce crime. It doesn't benefit our society. So I think we have to think really long and hard about why we would turn to that. What's the impulse behind that? And then seeing in real time what the impact of that increasing incarceration is. So when you go into a prison, it is now very overcrowded. Overcrowding means people are in even more discomfort. It elevates the risk of violence. It makes the working conditions extremely desperate for correctional employees. And it very much punishes anyone who has a connection to people in prison. When you have overburdened administrative systems within corrections, they're not processing visitor lists. They're not processing call permissions. You are not able to be in contact, to visit, to stay in community with your incarcerated relative because it's too burdensome to process all of this excess. We do not have in Canada any meaningful research that shows the impact of parental incarceration on children. So this study shows you the numbers, but we don't know what happened to these kids. We don't know where they are. Are they in foster care? Are they experiencing criminalization themselves? Are they in that foster care to prison pipeline? What happened to them? Because we made a state decision to put their parent in prison. That's the next step, obviously, is to say, okay, we know these children are here. Now we need to know what happens to them. And with the more we incarcerate people, the more we are going to see the numbers of impacted children increase. And that has all kinds of consequences for all of our social systems. This overburdening has spirals of impact.
When you talk about the next step for research there, so this step is identifying how many children have had incarcerated parents in Canada. Are you aware of anyone working on that next step for research of identifying maybe what happens to these kids?
Well, we're certainly continuing to work on this. So we have additional findings coming out soon that look at, for example, the increased risk of mortality, the relative increased risk that a child of an incarcerated parent will die when compared to a child in the general population. And we also have a study that looks at the increased risk of hospitalization based on injury. So, injury is a very common cause of hospitalization for children, but we are seeing very statistically significant indicators that children with incarcerated parents are more likely to experience injury resulting in hospitalization than just the child in the general public. So those are some things that are already coming through. We then have to be turning towards bigger picture, right? So this was a small sample. As more time goes by and as more provinces and the federal service, so the Correctional Services Canada, join this Statistics Canada Correctional Survey, that expands the data set and allows us to demonstrate more specificity. So, for example, in our findings, 30% of the children have Indigenous parents. Almost 6% have parents who are Black. If we changed the provinces that were included, if there were more northern territories involved, more prairie provinces, would that rate of Indigenous parents be even higher? Would we see that disproportionality even stronger? So that's one thing to consider. And then looking at those qualitative questions, what is it like for these children? What do their lives look like? What does it look like for the people who end up taking care of them, whether that's maybe a spouse, maybe a grandparent, or the foster care system?
Building on what you were talking about there, is there anything else you think it's important to highlight for people as far as the demographics of either the children or the parents involved in this study? I know, for example, it found that 77-ish percent of the parents were male. I've also read from some of your work that women are a very fast-growing population in prisons. I'm wondering if you can speak to some of those demographic issues.
Sure. So women are the fastest, and gender diverse people who would be incarcerated in prisons designated for women are the fastest growing population among prisoners. That said, they're about 7% of federal prisoners, about 15% of provincial prisoners. And so there are vastly more men who are incarcerated. And as a result, it's unsurprising that it's vastly more children who have a male incarcerated parent. We did have 12% of our sample had both parents incarcerated. We see increasingly the research in this area has certainly grown in my involvement in this over the past 10, 15 years. We know that the prison system is under-equipped to deal with sexual and reproductive health, including that early childhood time, that early infancy, postpartum stage. Prisons are under-equipped and they're not suited. And one of the only solutions that has ever been proposed is the mother-child program, this idea that we would incarcerate infants with their mothers as a remedy for increasing maternal incarceration. And this is another example of we've done something without evidence. So that program launched over 25 years ago in the federal prison system in Canada and at each of the six federal prisons for women across the country. So we have a program that costs a lot of money and it's been running for a long time. And we have no idea what happens to those children. Do they get vaccinated? Do they get to stay in their mother's custody when they leave prison? Do they have malnutrition? We don't know anything about these kids. And yet we propose this as a policy solution to another state, driven phenomenon of increasing maternal incarceration. It's really morally problematic, clinically problematic, and also fiscally problematic that we made this decision to put so much money into a program that we have no evidence of what it does. And this is why research is so important. We can think something might sound like a great idea, or we can think that parental incarceration is a fringe experience. But when you have the numbers, when you have the research, you can see what the real picture is. And it's very disturbing. It shines a very disturbing light on how Canada deals with social harm.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. I've been speaking with Martha Painter about a study she co-authored investigating how many children in Canada have incarcerated parents. We'll get you back to that conversation shortly. Jennifer Charlesworth is BC's representative for children and youth. Earlier this summer, she called for the rights of young people to be strengthened when their parents are involved with the criminal justice system.
We have about 2,000 children we serve through advocacy, and we have about 7,000 stories that we review of children who've experienced harms in our system. And so what you're trying to do when you've got that many stories of children is to take a step back and say, what are some of those common patterns and themes? And what we see is a significant number of children have parents that have been involved in the criminal justice system.
Charlesworth would like to see the system more actively consider familial ties.
What do we need to do to consider, are there other alternatives from complete separation of parent and child that would still ensure that there are appropriate consequences? We're not talking about inequities here, but also understand familial ties and the child's rights.
Charlesworth has written to BC's Attorney General on the issue.
We will be meeting with the Attorney General in September. And she will have has had an opportunity to review material and has expressed some interest in this. I know she cares deeply. And the other thing that I think is important to put this in context is this government and the Attorney General was one of the signatories to this, is committed to a child well-being plan in British Columbia. So that has flipped the perspective from protection only, but thinking about what do we need to do across systems to ensure children can be safe, connected, and thriving. And the criminal justice system is a part of that. So her interest, no doubt, is tied back into the commitment she's made to child well-being and making sure that, you know, legislation, regulation, policies, and practices line up to how can we do better for kids. So I'm looking forward to the conversation with her.
You're listening to People First Radio. Martha Painter is one of the authors on a study that estimated for the first time the number of Canadian children with incarcerated parents. It suggested that in any given year, more than 1% of kids have an incarcerated parent. The study text said rather plainly that parental incarceration violates children's rights. Can you talk me through that and maybe the whole idea or balance of that and what the justice system's stated aims are?
Well, Canada signed on a very long time ago, over 30 years, to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, CRC. And this international law states that every state decision, every government policy must be made in the best interests of the child. And so where is the evidence that children's interests are being considered when parents are incarcerated? The Bangkok rules, which are the United Nations minimum standards for the treatment of women prisoners, the first thing in those rules is that gender needs to be considered when sentencing. And the second thing is caregiving is paramount to the extent that it may very well be necessary to not have a custodial sentence to accommodate caregiving requirements. So we have these international laws that Canada has signed on to. Of course, they're not policed and they're not enforced, but they should speak to what we should expect of our government, because this is an expectation internationally. And we do not see courts making decisions based on the best interests of the child. We do not see children being discussed at all in sentencing decisions. The Canadian Coalition for Children of Incarcerated Parents came together in 2019 after a report that analyzed written sentencing decisions. So where there was that evidence that remained, and found just no examples of children being considered in sentences in Canadian courts. So despite these laws that require that we do this, and that's what we mean by children of incarcerated parents, just like all children in Canada, have the right to health and they have the right to their best interests being centered. We know that parental incarceration causes children harm. It harms their health. It causes them to die earlier. So what are we doing to address justice system processes to reduce that risk for children here?
And what would you advocate that we be doing?
I think we are prosecuting, and we are in an increasingly carceral society, which is very disturbing. We do not have increasing crime in this country. And yet we see the prisons getting fuller and fuller and fuller, and prisons, new prisons being built, and more investment in prison as a solution instead of things that may work or that do work, right? So that's the starting point. Let's prosecute fewer people. Let's criminalize less poverty, less mental illness, less substance use. But also, even when we are making more appropriate criminal charges, when we're seeing more reasonable application of the law, we have an obligation to be considering the best interests of the child in sentencing decisions. And to be writing it down to prove that it happened.
What does that look like, taking into consideration the best interests of the child in sentencing decisions when someone has been convicted of some kind of crime that would otherwise require incarceration under the current statutes?
So, for example, there was a recent initiative in Colombia where people who are caregivers of young children, women who are caregivers of young children, are released, sent home, and are obligated to do some community work and take care of their children and obviously not reoffend. And that's that. There are other examples like that where there's some type of community-based monitoring, basically like parole or probation or bail, that is the alternative, is the impulse, instead of greater toughness, instead of harshness, the impulse is towards reducing that harm and testing if perhaps a community-based alternative would work.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today on the study or the issues it's looking into?
Well, to remember that the court system, the justice system in Canada is a reflection of Canadian values, and to remember that these taxpayer-funded systems, you know, we have obligations as a state, we have obligations as, for me, as a clinician, there are obligations to patients to serve their best interests. So to be thinking about our obligations and the meaning of having so many children at risk of harm that's caused by state action. And then to think, really, with the lens of truth and reconciliation, what does it mean when 30% of those children have an Indigenous parent? How does perpetuating this cycle continue to perpetuate that genocidal colonial regime that Indigenous communities have experienced? So I call on us to think about our responsibilities and what we can tolerate from our different positionalities.
Martha, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on this.
My pleasure, Joe. Have a great week.
Martha Painter is an associate professor at the University of New Brunswick. She's one of the authors on a first-of-its-kind study that estimated the number of children in Canada with an incarcerated parent. The study was published earlier this year in the journal PLOS-1. A program in Manitoba helps inmates read to their kids. I spoke with the coordinator of Get the Story Out.
My name is Anna Sigrether. I work as the literacy coordinator for the John Howard Society of Manitoba. And the John Howard Society is a nationwide social service nonprofit that serves people in the justice system.
And today we are trying to get the story out about Get the Story Out. What is that?
So the Get the Story Out program is a storybook reading program that we offer to incarcerated folks in Manitoba. How it works is we partner with various institutions, correctional centers and jails, and we provide a series of children's books to those institutions and an audio recorder. And what happens is that incarcerated caregivers, somebody who's serving time or is being detained, who has a loved one on the outside who's a child, whether that's their own child or like a niece or nephew or little sibling, they can read that storybook aloud, have it audio recorded, and then we facilitate the getting that recording, on a CD as well as the book to the child. So they end up receiving this bedtime story from their loved one who they can't see every day because they're serving time.
What kind of context do you think people need to have about the prison system to maybe be able to appreciate what the program does?
Right. I mean, the key context is that, when you are incarcerated, basically a big part of the punishment is it's taking you away from your daily life and your relationships. It's very isolating. It removes you from your context, your community, your culture, your family, not to mention other things. And so while people do have the right to have visitors, the visitor process is also really fraught with bureaucratic challenges and sometimes distance for family members and just accessibility. And visits can be cut short. They can be, subject to if there's like a code on the floor that day, somebody might not even have a visit with their visitors. So having a storybook recorded is kind of like takes it out of the hands a little bit of that carceral setting, and the child can hear their loved one's voice, their caregiver's voice at home in a safe and comfortable space and keep that connection. And they can play it as many times as they want. We hear from families who like they play that pretty much every night before bed if it's a short story. So the context of isolation is really a and disconnection is a really big reason that Get the Story Out matters.
You talked a little bit about what it's like for people trying to maybe visit in person in prison. Outside of that, how are people who are incarcerated, how are they able to connect with their kids maybe outside of the program, like in terms of going on a Skype call or making a phone call? What is all of that like?
Right. Well, there's no Skype, certainly not in any Manitoba jails. I don't know about the rest of the country. It's technology is extremely limited, so there's just starting to be these tablets, basically like heavy duty iPads that a for-profit tech company has introduced and is gouging prisoners, charging 15 cents a minute for their use. Still, that's not even really offering any kind of Skype or video calling. So really the only way that people can stay in contact with their family is through phone calls, which you have to pay for, and you only get 15 minute phone calls, or through visits, which are really hard to coordinate and take a lot of resources usually for people to make happen. So it's just the Get the Story Out is just one small way that we can try to like offer people a little bit of a reprieve from that disconnection.
Sigrather says the program offers one small channel of connection, or in some cases, reconnection.
It's just in really, really practical terms, trying to offer just one more small channel of connection. And that is fighting against like a very, very like totalizing and I think almost entirely very traumatic disconnection that a child experiences if their parent is taken away and incarcerated. Obviously there can be other contextual factors in that child's life, but I don't believe that incarceration is ever a positive thing in a child's life. And so not least of which is the reason of their parent not being around anymore, right? If they have a close relationship with their parent and the parent is suddenly taken away, that's traumatizing. So, this program can offer a small, like just a small sort of channel of connection. It can also be a channel of reconnection. And I think that we've heard a few examples or sort of just there's been a few times during this program where the expression of interest by the person incarcerated to do this program has sort of been the first step towards mending a relationship, maybe with like an like a you know their child's other parent, who maybe they had lost contact with or had not had such a great relationship with prior to incarceration. And so sort of for this greater good of connecting with the child, it's been like a relationship mender. So yeah, I think that it can help in a lot of ways. And I think it's important to say it's like it's a very small way. This is by no means like solving the sort of traumatic disconnection of incarceration. It's just sort of a it's just a form of harm reduction and an offering.
Anna Sigrather is literacy coordinator for the John Howard Society of Manitoba. She was speaking there about their Get the Story Out program that offers inmates the opportunity to record audiobooks for their children. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio on CHLY on Local 107.3, that's CFMH, CFUV, Vancouver Co-op Radio, and Dig FM in the Comox Valley. You can also find past episodes of the show online. Just search People First Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.